Reset your system clock to 1990 and join us on today's Multimedia Hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. I'm your host, SuperVGA, and in today's episode, I'm going to talk about the adventure role-playing shareware game, Castle of the Winds. Well, hello again, Neglectorinos. I have been away for quite some time. It's your friend SuperVGA, and I'm so happy to be with you here today. With the farming season mercifully over, I can finally devote some time to sharing some Windows 3.1 stories and memories with you. So before we get to our main story, we've got quite the listener mailbag to go through. I apologize to those who wrote in. I replied to you individually via email, and I promised I would get these on the air as soon as I could. Well, it turned out to be 6 to 8 months later than I expected. So from way back in late spring, early summer, we've got an email from our friend Ben, who writes, "Hi, SuperVGA. It was lovely to listen in and reminisce about Sim Farm, a game I remember very fondly. It's interesting to hear you talk about the colors they used. I feel like it retains the style of the original Sim City, but with a color palette quite reminiscent of a stripped-down Sim City 2000. Huh. One fun Sim Farm memory comes from my time working on sheep farms." Okay, so I'm not the only farmer here. "I forgot what it's like to record when we have ambulances going by every 5 seconds. Well, I guess we'll get used to it. One of the younger farmers I worked for asked if I'd ever played Sim Farm one day. I told him that I had, and he proceeded to tell me that he tried it while at agricultural college, and he had found it much too hard. Apparently, his livestock kept escaping, causing him endless frustration, and he gave up playing it. Knowing the state of the fences on his real farm, this isn't too much of a surprise. I'll never forget the day that his father, having no rope to hogtie an escaped ram that he had caught, carefully trapped the ram beneath a fallen tree while he went to collect me to help him lift it. One of the many strange events that I witnessed on their farm. I have to wonder, though, at his Sim Farm methods, because I never thought the game was that hard, and farming ended up being his career. Thanks again for another episode, and I look forward to more gaming memories, Ben." Well, thanks, Ben. I hadn't thought of that before, but you're right. The color palette in Sim Farm really does remind me of SimCity 2000. There's something interesting about it. It's got this soft, gentle palette, both in Sim Farm and in SimCity 2000. That it's very relaxing to look at. It's almost like watercolor in some ways, at least part of the palette's watercolor. It's got some brighter highlights there that are a little bit sharper than the average watercolor. I think that says something when a sheep farmer tells you that your farming simulator is too hard compared to real farming. From my experience, it's quite the opposite. So thanks again, Ben. It was so great hearing from you. I really hope you get to write in. We've been talking online occasionally, and you've been mentioning that you've been keeping up, updating your Windows 3.1 machine with some new software. So I hope you can write in again and let us know. Oh, there's the ambulance again. That's a two siren alarm. I hope you can keep us updated on what you've added to your Windows 3.1 configuration. We've been talking a little bit about the differences between running games in DOSBox on our laptops versus running them on real physical bare metal hardware. And yeah, it's wonderful having both. I will get to my hardware story in a bit, but first, we have a wonderful email from first-time writing writer in Brett, writing in from Modesto, California. So Brett writes, "Hi, Super VGA. I've enjoyed the first six episodes of your show. In 1991, I got my first computer, which was a 10 megahertz Intel 8088 with 640K of RAM, a 20 meg Seagate ST225 hard drive, a CGA monitor, and a Panasonic KXP1124 dot matrix printer. We got it at a tiny clone computer store called Milky Way Computer in Fremont, California. We paid about $1,300 for the whole thing. I think the hard disk alone was $300. I still have the receipt. My first Windows operating system was Windows 3.0, which I got for Christmas." Wow, very cool. "We mailed in the registration paper for it, and a few months later received an upgrade offer for Windows 3.1 for $32. I took them up on the offer. The upgrade came with a Xenix, Xenix mouse. This is one of those American-Canadian things. We say Zed here, but it's probably Xenix. It came with a Xenix mouse. My Windows 3.1 story is probably no different from any other teenagers of the time. I came to DOS, from DOS to Windows. My first text editor in DOS 3.3 was Edlin." I'll get to that. "It was exciting to enter single line numbers manually. I did not hate it because I had nothing to compare it to other than a typewriter. Just to have a computer at home in 1991, if you did have one, you knew you were a winner." Agreed. "I did use Windows 3.0 with the 8088 and the CGA monitor a little in 1991. CGA has a 640 by 200 black and white graphics mode." Wow, that's pretty cool. "It can produce Windows, and Windows 3.0 supports the 8088, so it just barely ran. In 1992, I found the parts to buy a 386 SX25 AMD motherboard from the Computer Currents magazine. I got it from High Tech USA in Milpitas, California. That's just a short, that's just sort of a shout out to anyone else who shopped there. I love that store. Anyway, the 386 SX increased my Wing Commander game to a crazy frame rate and made Windows 3.1 work as well. At some point in there, I also got a 1 meg Oak VGA ISA video card. So that's how Windows 3.1 began for me. My favorite programs on Windows 3.1 were Microsoft Works 3.0, TrueSpace 2.0, TrueSpace, Caligari TrueSpace. Got to do an episode on that. Visual Basic 2.0 Pro, absolutely love VB myself. We'll get to that too. Compton's Encyclopedia, one of my first CD-ROMs. VB 2.0 was my first programming language for Windows. It was pretty awesome. Since then, I've moved in to C++ and other things. I'm a programmer today. I don't know whether Windows 3.1 can be credited with my interest in programming. I also loved writing games and screensavers with GW Basic and QBasic in DOS. Windows has a lot of strong nostalgic value, though. I made my first 3D animation in TrueSpace 2 for a high school project in Windows 3.1 on a 486DX 75 MHz with 8 megs of RAM. Ooh, what a hot machine. It's hard to believe you can even do 3D with 8 megs of RAM, but you could. So long as you saved often. I bug Microsoft to release new drivers for Windows 3.1 and 9X every once in a while, and even to sell them again. I'm sure they get a kick out of those emails. Thank you for making your podcast. It's a real treat to listen to. I wish there were more Windows 3.1 podcasts out there. I'm surprising that there are not, given that virtually everyone in the 1990s used it at home, work, or school. Also, I'm thinking that I'll try out Sim Farm game now. It sounds pretty cool." Oh, Great story, Brett. I seem to remember that Xenix Mouse was included in early copies of Windows 3.1. There's actually a whole interesting background story out there about Microsoft, their history with mice. It's from what I looked up, the earliest Microsoft mouse came out in 83 when they tried to introduce it as a mouse to use as an interface device for Microsoft Word. You know, that's pretty far ahead of its time. The only other mouse-based UI I can think of was the Macintosh, and that came out about a year later. I know that there were mice available for PCs, but it wasn't very used very commonly, especially not to be packaged specifically with a piece of software. I recently read, actually, that in 1990, Xenix sued Microsoft over a breach of contract over their deal with packaging the mouse with Windows 3.1. They eventually settled out of court on that one and, you know, would probably inspire many, 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 many breach of contract lawsuits that Microsoft has faced over the years, among other kinds of lawsuits. Regarding Edlin, Brett, the fact that you had to compare it to the next worst thing, a typewriter, kind of says it all to me. I remember finding Edlin utterly baffling as a kid because at the time I had a word processing suite in DOS called Better Working 8-in-1. It was a Spinnaker kind of product that was supposed to cover everything, kind of like Microsoft Office way before Office existed. Better Working 8-in-1's text editor was a decent DOS-based text editor that was not unlike Microsoft Word. It allowed you to move between the lines, most importantly, instead of entering line numbers once at a time. Edlin stood for Line Editor, if I remember correctly, and as a kid, I'd read the instructions for Edlin over and over in my Amstrad PC DOS manual, which was like the size of a King James Bible, trying to edit the autoexec.bat, and I'd get so frustrated because I didn't quite know how the line numbers worked. I didn't quite understand how the key commands worked for Edlin, even though I obviously had the manual right there in front of me. I must have figured it out somehow because I was stuck with Edlin for several years because we had DOS 3.31 or 3.33. That was our first version of DOS that we had on our computer, and it had no text editor aside from Edlin. It wasn't until we upgraded to our IBM PS1, which came with IBM PC DOS 6, which was kind of Microsoft's OEM release of MS DOS 6, that I finally got a really decent text editor. So I'm making fun of you, Brett. I'm sure you found a way to be fantastic with Edlin, but I never did. I'm pretty impressed that you managed to run Windows 3.0 with a CGA monitor on that 8088. One of these days, I want to do a full episode on the history of Microsoft Windows. But one of the things that Bill Gates was very specific about was maintaining 8088 compatibility with Windows 3.0. That was fairly an important thing at the time because the 286 was a fairly recent addition to the game and the 386 was coming out. The move towards 386 enhanced, etc., that's for a whole other episode, was a very big deal. So Microsoft really did put a lot of effort in maintaining backwards compatibility with hardware and software. On our 286, the Amstrad 286/30, we had Windows 2.0, which was surprisingly decent. But I do remember, even though our 286 had an 8 megahertz processor, it took quite a while to refresh and repaint the screen whenever you moved Windows around. So I can only imagine how much worse that was on an 8088. You sure made me smile thinking of what Wing Commander looked like on a 386. Boy, you know, was there anything better than seeing Wing Commander play smoothly on a machine? The jump from an 8088 to an SX25 must have been incredible, especially once you got that 1 meg Oak VGA card. For myself, this reminds me of a couple of stories. One was One time I managed to fry the motherboard on our PS1. I don't remember quite how I did it, but it got fried. I don't know if I caused it or if it was actually just a power surge, but it did fry the motherboard on our PS1, and we had to get it replaced in town. Thankfully, the machine was under warranty, and this bothers me to this day. I'll never forget this, folks. The PS1 actually came with, unbelievably, a 1 meg video card built into the motherboard. So you got very, very high color depth out of this machine right out of the box. Now, the trick was, it got that 1 meg by having a chip socketed onto the board. It was just a VRAM chip, basically. We would never imagine adding RAM to our cards these days, but you could back then. So the VRAM chip was socketed. You could pull it in, pull it out. We sent this motherboard off to be repaired. IBM did it under a warranty with a local computer store. Got the machine back. And it wasn't until maybe 6 months later that I noticed I couldn't go into high color mode in Windows 95, I believe. And I was wondering what's going on. So I opened up the machine, and sure enough, they replaced the motherboard. They did not replace the wonderful, I think it was a 512 kilobyte socketed VRAM chip that went on the board. I'm sure it was just an oversight. I don't think anybody stole it, but oh, I was so mad. I was so mad that somebody, you know, forgot about half a meg of RAM that belonged on this thing. So it meant that I could only run the machine in kind of, I think, 256 color mode in Windows, which drove me crazy. That meant, of course, that I had an excuse to upgrade it to a Pentium 133 soon afterwards, but that's another story for another time. The real story I was thinking of about your 8088 reminds me of a story involving a friend of mine. While we were growing up, I was about, 16 or 17 years old. He was my age. He had a very similar machine to yours. It was an 8088 with a 20 meg hard drive and a CGA graphics card. Except he had an amber monochrome monitor. You didn't mention if your monitor was color or not, but his wasn't. So CGA graphics card, but amber monitor. He used that machine until 1999, if you can believe it. One day he was telling me he was going to go check his email. So this is around 1999, mid-99. Late 99. So he took me down into the basement and we crowded around his 8088. It looked like kind of a standard IBM 5150 knockoff style box, if you know what I'm talking about. His machine had an external 9600 baud modem attached, and he dialed up into a local free internet dial-up service called Freenet. Freenet gave you an hour of free surfing a day, which was amazingly generous at the time, considering that, you know, you always had to pay for an ISP or you had to go through some sort of university dial-up system, which itself was always, always, always crowded. And that's what I used, was the free dial-up system. Now, of course, his machine, his 8088, did not have a WinSock TCP/IP stack. I don't know if you could get a TCP/IP stack for Windows 3.0. That's something I probably should check into someday. So his only option was to view it through the terminal program he used. His machine didn't have Windows, period. It was actually just DOS-based. So he was dialing in to this Freenet thing using their terminal-based email system, which I believe was Pine, actually. So they were running some sort of Unix-based system and offering email through Pine. That was my first email client as well. And then he would, you know, he would check his email. I think he was able to sort of surf the web using Lynx, L-Y-N-X, if anybody remembers Lynx from the Unix days. And that was it. Now, keep in mind, at this point at home, I had, this was 99, so I would have a 56K modem with a 99. I was probably running an AMD K6 2300 or 350. So, you know, leaps and bounds apart. So anyway, a few months later, he had a few few hundred bucks. I think he had $500 or $600 to spend, and he wanted to upgrade his computer. He was living at home at the time, and his dad kept asking if we could somehow upgrade his 8088. And I kept telling his dad, no, it's not possible. It's not even worth trying. Don't try. So him and I went to the local computer shop, and we went through their price list and came up with what we could build for under $500. It turned out we could build a pretty awesome machine. And it would come with an AMD K62 processor. And I think it had somewhere between 64 and 128 megs of RAM. It had a 20 gig hard drive instead of 20 megs. And it had some sort of snappy 2D, 3D accelerated video card. Probably not great. I remember it being a very low-end video card, very cheap. And it came with a 17-inch Super VGA monitor. It wasn't the fastest machine in the world at the time. I believe that K63 and Pentium 3 processors were already out or around the bend, but it was a quantum leap from the 8088 he had been using. I remember building the machine for him, and I was excited to see his reaction when we booted it up for the first time, and I could show him a game like, I think we were playing at that point, Soldier of Fortune, the game's escaping my mind right now. What very early 3D games, but I remember Soldier of Fortune was a big deal for it. And he saw this thing boot up and went straight into, I think we were running Windows 98 or 2000 at that point. I think it was 98. And he looked at the screen and he said, "Whoa, it's in color. Cool." Yeah, it's in color. I hadn't thought that the move from CGA monochrome to something like 32,000 colors, 32K colors, was going to be the most noticeable jump for him. But there you have it. That was the most important thing. So thanks, Brett, for the great memories, and thanks for inspiring a few memories of my own. Please write in again if any of these stories in the show remind you of things, or if you've got recent memories about Windows 3.1 experiences of your own. And I'd like to extend that a bit. I said Windows 3.1. Let's say Windows 3.1 era stories, because although I do talk about Windows 3.1 programs on this show mostly, there's no reason we can't be talking about DOS stuff, because let's face it, I played almost everything in DOS at that point. There were very, very few Windows 3.1 specific games I played. So it's great to have another listener with such a great memory for the golden era of PC computing. Write in again sometime, Brett. It was great talking to you. So on to updates. You might not know this, but I normally record the music for the podcast directly from the AW64 Gold attached to my Packard Bell Legend 486. That machine has a comfy place right beside my gigantic 27-inch iMac, and I have it attached to a cute little 17-inch Dell LCD monitor, if only because it's been very hard finding a CRT monitor locally. They're very expensive all of a sudden, because I assume people know that they are for collectors only, and everyone else junked theirs years ago. So I've got this little 17-inch LCD, and it does its work. A few months ago, I started to notice some really weird flaky behavior on the Packard Bell. I noticed it wouldn't boot occasionally, or it would boot and produce these really random colored ASCII symbols all over the screen. Sometimes the ASCII characters were actually reversed in some of the spots with each other, so it produced this hilarious, you know, gobbledygook every time it loaded. So at first I thought it was a virus. After all, I've been testing some of my original floppy disks in my boxed games for a few months. It was possible, I thought, that I had maybe inadvertently infected it from something from an old save game from years ago. So I spent some time putting FPROT on the machine, if you remember, FPROT. It was a very early DOS-based virus scanner, an excellent one, by the way. I found the most recent version using the most recent virus definitions I could find, and it came up with nothing. So I thought, okay, either this is a fairly new DOS-based boot sector virus, because it was actually showing up during boot, or more likely that I just had no virus at all. So one day, about 2 weeks ago, the machine booted with corrupt graphics and nothing else. It didn't even detect the RAM on board. That's a bad sign. So I cracked open the case, and my first thought was, okay, let's check that internal CMOS clock battery because I've been a little concerned about it. Everyone says, remove it, cut it out, desolder it. I didn't have time. Oh, one sec, my music started playing here. I am live editing this in GarageBand as we speak. So I'm not big into editing after the fact. It's a lot of work. So back to the story. I dug around in the motherboard, found the clock battery. It looked fine on the outside, and then I moved my flashlight to the back edge where I couldn't see it behind the shadow. You know, the side of the motherboard facing the serial ports at the back. And damn, sure enough, the battery had leaked corrosive acid all over the back of the board. So I stripped the board, I removed it, I surveyed the damage, and the acid had leaked in a good 6-inch radius around the battery, and it had corroded a lot of terminals. I didn't see any broken traces, but it's hard to say because those traces, they could be broken underneath that green layer of solder mask. That's the green layer that prevents connections from arcing with each other. And it's possible that the acid had gotten beneath the solder mask and corroded some of those traces. So I did my best. I cleaned the board thoroughly with a combination of vinegar, and the vinegar is there to neutralize the potassium carbonate. That's the white stuff used as an electrolyte inside of the battery. Even in the nickel-cadmium battery, which I'm holding in my finger here, that's that little guy. Very, very frustrating to see this white stuff all over the battery. So cleaned it up with some vinegar. I used some denatured alcohol to clean up the mess afterwards and just some plain old water. So after several cleanings, like this is three trips back to the sink with my denatured alcohol in hand, the machine still wasn't detecting on the RAM. So something double plus ungood is happening there. So I've unfortunately had to shelve it. I've cleaned up the damage, I think, but I need to order another battery and maybe think about replacing some capacitors on that board. It's very, very possible that the capacitors have also went along with the battery. It's hard to say what's causing the problem. It's even possible that the machine's just not booting because there's a voltage irregulation caused by the battery being completely removed. I'm afraid of connecting both sides of the battery terminal without a battery because this was a NiCad battery meant to be charged by that circuit. And unless it's in there, I could put in a resistor, but I don't even know what the right size would be. It just seems like a bad idea to run it without the battery. So it's either getting too little voltage or too much. I'm suspecting that has something to do with it. It's also possible, and this is thanks to listener Ben, who pointed this out, that the power supply is on its way out. It's a 20-year-old power supply. It's very likely that that's got some bad caps too. So I may try swapping in an ATX power supply with an AT power converter. This allows you to use the ATX cables on an AT machine. Because I found that AT power supplies are pretty expensive on eBay, and I don't really trust them if they're already 20 years old themselves. So if you've gotten any ideas on what to do to diagnose or repair this board, please, I'm all ears. And thank you to listener Brian, who posted pictures of my corrupted boot to his Twitter account. This is Brian Demodulated. He got some really, really great tips, I believe, from Jim Leonard, who's Trickster. Jim and I have talked online at some point many, many years ago. Jim had some suggestions on how I might fix this. Turns out that it could be a lot of things wrong with the board. It could even be something wrong with the video RAM. We eliminated video RAM as a possibility. But anyway, there's a lot of different possibilities. Thanks, Brian, for checking into it. I really appreciate it. So I know we're already half an hour into the show, but I can't help but do an inventory check. I don't know if I've told you folks this, but over the past year, I've been trying to sell off a significant number of my PC boxed games. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this to you on the show before, but I've got about 1,000 games from all kinds of systems. That's an Amiga, the Macintosh, the original Macintosh, I should say, Commodore 64. Most of them, the majority of them, are DOS-based or Windows 3.1, 95, 98-based. Every console and every handheld machine you can think of, well, those are all stashed away in crates in my bedroom. In fact, it takes about two-thirds of our bedroom space up to the ceiling just to keep these organized. So you can imagine how happy that makes my wife. I'm hanging on to the stuff that carries some heavy personal meaning for me. For instance, I've got this somewhere on my shelf, a wonderfully beautiful Ultima diskette. This is Ultima, not Ultima 1, Ultima, as released by California Pacific Computers back in, I won't even hazard a guess, 1980, 1981. I would love to get that signed by Richard Garriott someday. But anyway, I've got all these games. I'm selling some of them off. I'm hanging on to those, not the super rare stuff, just the stuff that really matters to me. So that means around 200 of them I'm keeping, about 800 plus are going onto the auction mill. So, that being said, I have very few new things in my inventory, except for a few cool ones, like, I'm going to grab this off my shelf, I'm holding on to a copy of Starflight. Starflight came out in, I have to check the date on this, oh, it's not even on the back of this box. This is how early this was in EA's history. I think it's around 84 or 85. This was an Electronic Arts published game in a beautiful album-style case that EA made famous back in the days where they were promoting the programmers as artists. This box is really thick with documentation. It feels as heavy as an actual, like, double LP album. And it folds out into a beautiful kind of painterly look at the solar system and from a planet's point of view. It's a great game. I have two people to thank for this. One is Joe Mastroianni of the Upper Memory Block podcast. Joe did an amazing episode on Starflight, which really inspired me to find a copy of this. Somebody should tell Joe about this podcast sometimes. He might give him a little bit of a kick to see that some of us were so influenced by his podcast that we went on to do our own kind of thing. And hey, Joe, maybe it'll inspire you to get back at making new episodes for us. Don't worry, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. It took me 6 or 8 months just to make this episode. So what I love about this game is just that it's... Oh, sorry, I didn't get to tell you. The other big influencer is, again, listener Ben. Ben recommended Starflight as well as its sequel and the third unofficial game in the series that I didn't know about called Protostar. I remember Protostar sitting in the bargain bin when I was a kid, and I avoided buying it because it had... I think Tsunami Media on it, which suggested to me this was going to be kind of a low-quality game. I seem to remember Tsunami being full of ex-Sierra veterans who left after Sierra fell apart or during its acquisition era. Same thing, I guess. So thank you so much, Ben, for recommending this. The best part of this story, I got it for $15. Even though the shipping alone was twice as much as what I paid, $15, I couldn't say no. I think the next nearest copy was, I think, $100 US. So super happy to get this game. I can't wait to play it. And I'm so happy that I actually have the proper copy protection for it, because the code wheel's a pain in the butt to use on GOG. All right, so let's move on to our main topic. Rick Sada's Castle of the Winds. So I found Castle of the Winds on a BBS in 1992 or thereabouts. I was on a 2400 baud modem that came pre-installed on my family's PS1, which I've talked about much on this show. So at 2400 baud in 1992, most sysops considered you scum of the earth. It took about 2 hours to transfer a 1 meg file, And file sizes were creeping up very quickly by that point. Most serious software pirates had a 14.4K modem by that point. And, you know, tying up a BBS's only line for 2 hours just to get one file was sacrilege to most sysops in the early 90s. So my only real option was to find games that were under a meg. And the other real reason was, too, because I couldn't upload much, I didn't have download credits to spare, so I only really got offered usually 1 meg of download credits from most BBSs. So that meant I needed to basically track down low-density-based shareware games, and Castle of the Winds was one of them. In fact, I think it even fit on a low-density 5.25-inch disk, if you can believe it. That's 360 kilobytes. So Castle of the Winds was the first shareware game I ever downloaded. I managed to download it using the Windows terminal, because at the time I didn't have a better terminal dialer that would come much later in the form of Terminate. The game sat in my games folder of my very carefully arranged Windows 3.1 desktop for years. Sadly, I never played the registered version as a teenager because the $25 price tag was a fair bit out of my reach. And besides, I didn't have a checkbook or a credit card, and try to convince my mom to order me something from a mail order catalog, especially for a video game, in 92-93, not gonna happen. So, what is Castle of the Winds? It's a top-down, tile-based, turn-based role-playing game. Okay, that's enough tease for now. If you've played any of the early Ultima series of games, say anything from Ultima 1 through 6, you'll find it fairly familiar. If you're not familiar with a top-down RPG, think about standing over a giant tabletop grid. Every space on that grid has a tile representing some piece of the world. That one there's grass, this tile there is a door, that long line of tiles are walls. Given enough of a different selection of tiles, you can combine them in different ways to make interesting indoor and outdoor environments. So it's not just the environment, of course. You play as a single character, and you place that character in the middle of the grid, and each time you move the character, the entire grid moves around you, making it look like you are basically standing and walking, and the world's running underneath your feet. So, like Ultima, Castle of the Winds is a mix of exploration in towns and dungeons, but there is no overworld exploration, however. It is purely, you're either in town or you are in a dungeon. Unlike Ultima, many of the dungeons in this game are randomly generated, and only some of them are pre-designed. That's very, very cool, and we'll talk about what led the developer to design it that way. The most interesting visual difference between Ultima and Castle of the Winds is that this game is Windows 3.1 native, something none of the Ultima games ever went on to doing. It uses the Windows Graphics Programming API to take advantage of its 16 color mode at 640 by 480. I think it was even capable of 256 colors, but the game itself used 16 colors with dithering. That gives the game a surprisingly good graphical fidelity at a time where, if you think about 1990, its nearest cousin would probably be Ultima 5, 6. By 92, when I played it, the nearest game would be Ultima 7. All of these running at 320 by 200 and 256 colors, so fairly low res. Now, no one's going to say that Castle of the Winds looks more beautiful than even Ultima 5 or 6. Definitely not 7. But there's something fun and restful about its visual design. To me, it's like someone took a bunch of Windows 3.1 icons that they found hidden in one of the Windows DLLs and found a way to arrange them into a map. It's programmer art, no doubt, but it works, and it does a great job for what it needs to do. So even cuter, I love this, you can import your own custom icon as your character's avatar in the game. So if you've got enough skill with creating a Windows 3.1 icon, I can't remember, I think it's called Windows Icon Creator. Back in the Windows 3.1 days, I can't even remember what I would have used. Some shareware product, I'm sure. You can design your own character and import them into the game. So take that, Dragon Age. There's something just plain likable about Castle of the Winds. It's that feeling you get when you play a game that it's clear that one person put their heart and soul into the project, and it shines through. So what is the game really about? It's the standard dungeon crawl kind of game. There is a storyline. Your farm burns down, you're an orphan, and the orphan has a big deep secret that you need to find out by the end of the game. And this sends you through a series of, I believe, three towns in the first episode. Each town has its own dungeon associated with it. In order to complete the town and move on to the next town, you must complete the dungeon. I like that structure. It makes it actually playable in smaller doses. Now, I thought there were some really nice surprises with this game. I'm not going to go into huge amount of detail with gameplay, because it follows the pattern of most, I would say, roguelike or NetHack-like games, except for what I'm going to talk about now, a few nice surprises along the way. One is tooltips. You can right-click on anything and get a tooltip explanation of what the item is, what that tile is, or if you right-click on a GUI element, it tells you what the button's for. It's really helpful because then you don't have to dig through a help file to understand everything. You can just right-click on things to figure out what they are. Monsters all give descriptions. It's wonderful. Great use of the mouse-based interface. I thought it was cute that when you die, and you will die a lot, there's a RIP kind of rest in peace tombstone every time you die, and it adds your name, your character's name, and how you died. This sure reveals the developer's love for Rogue and NetHack. Or potentially, I doubt he played this, but also the original classic adventure edutainment game I'm thinking of. I can't bring it to mind right now. Somebody say it for me. Say it out loud. Can't hear you. It'll come to me. The one, Oregon Trail. Jeez, how could it take me that long to remember Oregon Trail, the game I grew up with in elementary school? So anyway, you get a tombstone. It has a surprisingly large and detailed help file with explanations for everything, including even a bestiary of monsters. That was a big surprise to me because at the time, shareware games like Microman were not quite known for their for their very in-depth manuals. At best, you would say, here are the keys, here's how to move, go do your thing. Excuse me for a sec, I need some water. So I was really impressed to see actually a manual that was about as long as the manuals you'd find in any Ultima game. Maybe not the same quality, but again, having a bestiary or beastiary, as I used to say as a kid, very impressive. So other things I found interesting in the game, when your mana hits zero, so you can have spellcasting abilities. This game offers both, let's say, a warrior path and a mage path, or you can be a spell sword, anything you like by adjusting the sliders in the game when you create your character. The great thing is, when your mana hits zero, unlike 98% of the RPGs I've played, you can still cast spells. But if you do cast when your mana is zero, it starts to use up your hit points and give you hit point damage. I mean, what a brilliant idea. Because there are times when you say to yourself, you know what, my hit points are really, really close to zero. If I cast a spell and eliminate this enemy using a fireball or something like that, I can get that past this one spot that's blocking me to go get healed or something. So what an awesome idea. It has an excellent drag and drop interface for your character and inventory. In the Ultima series, this eventually became what were called gumps in Ultima 7 specifically. I was just very impressed to see this in a game so early. The gump system really didn't appear and wasn't very usable until later games, let's say Ultima 7, Ultima 8, even Ultima Online. This is very, very early on. Keep in mind, this game was released by 89 or 90. So he figured out a drag and drop interface for, the developer, Rick Sata, had came up with this very beautiful interface very early on, and it reminds you of something that's very commonplace now, but at the time no one was doing this. You'd have to equip things by hitting E, selecting the thing to equip, and then it would appear on your character. This is just drag and drop right onto your character's GUI. Love it. Wonderful design, Rick. The game comes with two sets of keyboard movement keys. Man, what a lifesaver. These days, very few keyboards actually come with the numeric keypad built in. At least that's true for Macintosh, iMac-based machines. You get just a plain old keyboard without the numeric keypad. This game offers two sets of movement keys, so you can use the alpha keys to move around too, and that's covered in the help file if you need to know those keys. Really helpful for those of us on laptops who don't have the built-in numeric keypad. Another nice thing, and this is something I want to talk about in the developer story, is that the first episode of the shareware version is the complete game. It does not unceremoniously cut you off from the story. You get to play one complete experience. The developer actually mentions this in the shareware nag screen, that if you like the game, you're required to pay for it. So, and that'll get you this version and its sequel, when you pay for it. So it means you're playing the fully registered version of the first game, which is very cool. It's an interesting concept, and that's what distinguishes shareware from, say, a game demo that'll cut you off after 20 minutes or by some level. Very, very cool. So you got to actually experience a whole story in the first episode of the shareware game. The game was released into the public domain by Rick Sauda in 1998 or 99, so you can download the registered versions. That's Castle of the Winds 1 and 2 for free, completely for free. Another thing I really liked about this game is that it's mouse-based. Most roguelike games to this day are still heavily keyboard-based because back in the old days, we'll talk about this in the development story, they were based on terminals. And that stayed the norm ever since. Very few roguelikes come with very good mouse support. I think the only one I can think of to this day is Cogmind. But the developer really focused on using the mouse for everything, and it does a really great job of that. Makes it fun to play with a trackpad, honestly. So another thing I really liked about this is that you can save and restore at any time. This is a huge lifesaver because most roguelike games are built on what's called permadeath, and they don't allow you to save anywhere, or if they do let you save, you might get away with saving in town or something. This allows you to save or restore anywhere. Really helpful for somebody like me, trust me. Now on to the not-so-nice surprises, and there's really only one not-so-nice surprise, and this maybe is just specific to me. The game is hard. It's damn hard. You really get the sense the developer loved NetHack and wanted to make you work for every single copper coin you find. I died a dozen times in the first 10 minutes. It's not your casual Monday afternoon time killer at the office type game. This is a full-on RPG. You're going to get your butt kicked. Now, I know that my patience and my skills have deteriorated over the years, but I actually last longer in the average game of NetHack than I do in Castle of the Winds. That explains why I never finished the game, and it sat on my desktop for years in my Windows 3.1 and later Windows 95 install until the hard drive on that PS1 finally croaked and is now sitting inside my little drawer here. Now, I suspect once you get over the initial difficulty curve, the game becomes much more playable. But when I started off the game, I had 10 hit points to use. I didn't even last more than two swings against a skeleton or a goblin, and I was dead. I save-scummed a whole lot with this game, and it didn't even help. That's telling me that either A, the game is deeply unbalanced, which I don't think is the case, I suspect that I just rolled up a really poor character and I tended to go for medium strength, medium dexterity, medium magical powers. I suspect to win this game, you're probably going to have to min-max your strength and dexterity to be a really good warrior, or max out your spell power to be a really good mage. I wanted to be a spell sword because that's what I usually play in every game. Kind of a spell sword healer, if that makes any sense. And it didn't work out. So if you're wondering, by the way, There are four or five different toggles for difficulty. I was playing on easy mode, and I still got my butt handed to me every single time I played it. So that was my experience of the game. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. Probably the best, or at least well-known, RPG for Windows 3.1 that I've ever seen. On the tech stuff category, there isn't much to say other than the fact that the game is lacking something. It doesn't use the audio subsystem of Windows 3.1 at all. No MIDI, no WAV files. That's something we can cover a little bit in the dev story, because I think it's actually really interesting. There's might be a good reason why it has no support for MIDI or WAV. The only thing it does use, and I noticed this while I was rolling up my character, is it uses the PC speaker for certain GUIs. So it'll actually ring out the PC beeper occasionally. So if you have that cranked up, turn it down for this game. All right, so on to the game's development history. This is where I get excited about. This is what I love talking about. This is my favorite part of Joe Mastriani's Upper Memory Block podcast. And this is my focus, of course, for this show. Castle of the Winds was created by a Microsoft programmer by the name of Rick Sada. Now, I'm saying Sada. I don't think it's Sada. So, Rick, if you ever hear this podcast someday, if you happen to know Rick, please pass this on to him. I apologize for mispronouncing your name. If I got it right the first time, I'll take full credit. So Rick grew up in Ohio in the 1970s and began working with computers just at the beginning of the personal computer revolution. Although he didn't have a computer of his own at the time, his dad reportedly had a few PCs in his research lab. One of these computers was a DEC PDP-11, running the RT-11 operating system. The PDP-11 in his dad's lab had a copy of Crowther and Woods' Colossal Cave Adventure. Now, how many game developers over the years have had that in their personal backstory? Rick Sada began learning BASIC on those lab computers soon after playing Colossal Cave Adventure and created his own text adventure called Iron Mountain. Because BASIC only ran on that one computer, I'm assuming he means that particular flavor of BASIC ran on that one machine. I'm assuming he was building this on the PDP-11. It couldn't be used on his friends' computers who had TRS-80s and Apple IIs. Rick didn't have a home-based computer, so he was building all of this in his dad's lab. He mentions that only one or two of his friends, I'm assuming, who visited the lab, ever got to play Iron Mountain, but he kept a copy of the BASIC code for that game on thermal paper printouts. Rick, I probably should send you an email sometime and see if you still have those thermal paper printouts. I'd love to scan them in, digitize them, and see if we can port Iron Mountain to a more publicly usable form of BASIC to this day. So anyway, fast forward a few years. In 1983, Rick Sada starts attending Princeton for the first time. He's been at Princeton for a while doing his undergrad, and he runs across the game Rogue. Now, if any of you have played Rogue, this is the game that sets the standard for what we call the roguelike. He remembers the class at the time, I'm assuming this was probably a CS class, using a DEC VAX11/750. I looked this up because I don't have a lot of experience with VAX-based computers. I did use a VAX Unix mainframe back in the bad old days of 1992, but that was only remotely via terminal, and I have no idea which VAX machine it was. The VAX11/750 was the mini computer, a VAX 11, that had been shrunken down to the size of a mini fridge. Now, that's pretty impressive because I saw the original VAX 11, it was the size of two upstanding fridges. So a mini fridge kegged was probably pretty amazing. I'm guessing that Rick's CS class was probably using this VAX 11 in a time-sharing environment, so the whole class was probably using that one little mini fridge to do their work. He was laughing in the interview I read, mentioning that all of the instances of Rogue running on it brought the machine to its knees. So I can imagine that. I think it was a 6 megahertz computer running multiple copies of Rogue. I'm not quite sure how the time sharing system worked on it. So now Rogue left an impression on Rick after years of playing text adventures, where once you finish the story, there wasn't really anything worth replaying. Rogue, however, had random level and loot generation, which meant a potentially infinite number of encounters and stories that you could generate from it. Oh, I'm getting a couple of messages from our friend Brian here. Hi, Brian. I'm recording a podcast. You know what? I'll tell you that right now, Brian. Sorry about that, folks. So, Brian and I are friends on Steam. Feel free to friend me on Steam if you'd like. He says, wow, great. He's probably shocked at the fact that I'm actually recording something. So the fact that Rogue had this randomization, this procedural generation built into it, left a huge impact on him. So we'll go back into his personal story. Rick finishes his degree at Princeton, his undergrad degree. He applies to go to grad school, next natural step. He applies to MIT, several other graduate programs in California, I think Stanford, Berkeley, I can't remember, there was a big list of them. So thinking he might need a backup plan in the off chance that he's rejected by all of them, he applied for a job at Microsoft, where several of his friends were now working. Well, thank heavens he did, because he was rejected by all those grad school applications. His application was rejected by all those grad schools. So in 86, Microsoft hired Rick just prior to their IPO. I assume this worked out quite well for him. Despite programming games as a hobby, Rick didn't land a job on Microsoft's, well, let's face it, their non-existent games team, but that would have been cool if he had. He was hired to work on the MS-DOS version of Word. But after seeing Windows 2.0, he saw the future as being in mouse-driven GUIs. That led him to learn the Windows Programming API, which was in its infancy at the time. Now, he thought that learning to program a game would be the best way of learning the API, as it would take advantage of almost all of the API's features. You can imagine what these would be. Pushing graphics to the screen using some sort of blit, probably using the keyboard and mouse APIs, most importantly, file storage and saving and loading, that kind of stuff. Oh, sorry, I should talk about this. What's an API? An API is an acronym for Application Programming Interface. It's kind of an intermediate step between a software library, meaning the library takes care of the specific implementation of how to blit a bitmap to the screen, and the programmer, whose job is to say, I need to put something on the screen. It abstracts away the really nitty-gritty hardware and software problem of how to implement these things, and gives the programmer a simple interface to work with. So instead of writing 1,000 lines of code to push a bitmap to the screen, you might write just 3 lines of code, one that loads the bitmap, a second that paints the bitmap, and a third that shows the bitmap to the user. Very, very wonderful stuff when you can start using APIs. It shrinks down programming time by a ton. So Rick started building his roguelike game, intentionally taking cues from a few roguelikes. Of course, Rogue itself, a Noah Morgan's game called Larn, which I had to learn up, which I had to read up on. I'm starting to mix my language here in my show notes. I had to read up on Larn. It's another kind of roguelike with its own particular flavor and style. I didn't go into any depth with it playing it. He also played the Lawrence Brothers Omega, as well as the game that I'm most familiar with, NetHack. Now, there's something cool that I hadn't noticed in Castle of the Winds. Before getting started on the game, Rick remembers reading a lot of mythology over the years, and Norse mythology became the background for Castle of the Winds. Now, keep in mind at the time that almost every other D&D-style game relied very heavily on high fantasy borrowed from, most D&D settings, and those themselves were borrowed directly from Tolkien. This set his game apart, at least very much so thematically. Now, Rick spent years working on the game, and he would expand it and improve it on the storyline with the help of a friend named Ben. I don't know how to pronounce your last name, Ben. I'm guessing his name is Getter, G-O-E-T-T-E-R. That was until the release of Windows 3.1 was around the bend. Around that time, Windows 3.1, I should have said Windows 3.0. He kicked things into high gear around Windows 3.0's release date because he wanted to release it around the same time. Very smart move. Before release, he decided he wanted some feedback from other people other than his friends, so he put the game up on Microsoft's corporate network. Well, it wasn't soon afterwards that he noticed the same group of players were grabbing the game as soon as he uploaded a new beta. One of those players, Paul Caniff, went on to help Rick draw the town artwork in the game, which does stand out as actually fairly good perspective-based artwork to me. At least for programmer art. Saving and restoring were very intentional additions to the game. He didn't like that. NetHack forced you to replay 10 to 15 hours of the game just to get back to the same place that you died at. He wanted something fun, not hardcore. So saving and loading features, you can save it, load any time in the game, was an important part of that. He finished the game in 1989 and was thinking about how to release it. He thought about releasing it via self-publishing and promoting it through BBSs, etc. But he was approached by none other than the head honcho of Epic Mega Games, Tim Sweeney. I need some water. Now, excuse me, he liked that Wolfenstein 3D used what he called a sequelware model, where the first episode was a full episode, and the second and third episodes came via purchase of the retail or registered versions. Tim Sweeney offered him a deal for publishing where Epic would take over distribution and sales, meaning distribution uploading to every BBS you can imagine, as well as reselling it through physical shareware copies through grocery stores. And there were a million local software distributors who did that. At $25 US, the game sold about 13,500 copies through Epic Mega Games mail order system, which I thought was pretty darn good. I think that actually outsold Tim Sweeney's own shareware game. The name is escaping my mind right now. Whose father sold it through the same shareware mail order address. Later, the game would get a retail box release for part two and appear on shelves in Walmart. So actually, I think parts one and two both came out at Walmart. So, and he said he sold a lot more in stores than he did in shareware. So I thought that was pretty cool. One thing of note I thought was very interesting. This game came out in Windows 3.0 and in the Windows 3.0 era prior to the multimedia extensions edition that came out, which got integrated into Windows 3.1. My suspicion is Rick probably didn't have access to the multimedia extensions, which would allow for built-in MIDI and WAV support, until so late in the project that he wouldn't have had time to add an audio subsystem to the game. So that's my suspicion. Someday somebody can talk with Rick about it and find out if that was what really caused things to go that way. So anyway, Rick continued to work at Microsoft for a few more years until, unfortunately, a repetitive strain injury forced him to retire. He went on to join some friends at Flying Lab Softwares a few years later, who built the game Rails Across America and a couple of others that I have, and they would eventually go on to create the popular MMO Pirates of the Burning Sea. So that's our developer story. I thought it was really fascinating. This was all thanks to a great interview Rick did over at Gamma Sutra. So thank you for that. Now, where to get it? Castle of the Winds 1 and 2 are free. Rick Sauda released them into the public domain in the late 90s. It's a 16-bit only game, so you are going to have to be running this either on original hardware or, in the case of what I do, DOSBox with a Windows 3.1 install, as my poor Windows 3.1 machine has met its maker. In the early 2000s, there was a remake attempted. A company or a person named Leptune began building an MMO of Castle of the Winds using Rick Sauda's original source code, which he lent them. I think that the project stalled around 2014, but from what I saw, it apparently did have the game running in Windows 32-bit mode, which is pretty cool. So that's it, folks. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Multimedia Hyper Guide. I really hope to do these episodes once a month. It was a little hopeful of me doing them weekly, and by the time my farming season kicked into gear, there was no hope for me of even doing monthly episodes. So for now, I'm going to do monthly episodes. In our next episode, it's going to be a DOS prompt episode. I think I want to do Starflight, but you can tell me what episode you think I should do next. It will be DOS prompt for sure. So it's been so wonderful talking to you again. I hope you get to listen to this at or before Christmas. This is my little Christmas gift to you, all of you listeners who are still hanging on. I really appreciate you sticking around. I promise I will give you more episodes again monthly. All right, I will talk to you soon. And until next time, have a great Christmas.